This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patti Smith is considered the godmother of punk. In the 70s, she created a hybrid of poetry and rock and developed a high-energy performance style that was sometimes aggressive, sometimes ecstatic. Her first album, Horses, which was released in 1975, has just been reissued in a 30th anniversary double CD package that also includes a concert version of songs from the album, recorded in June 1975 in London. In 1980, Smith left the music scene to raise a family with her husband, the musician Fred Smith. Outside of an album they collaborated on in 1988, she kept out of the public eye until 1996, which was about 2 years after her husband died of heart failure. I spoke with her that year, after the release of her CD, Gone Again. Let's start with a track from the new reissue of Horses.
Boy was in the hallway drinking a glass of tea. From the other end, the rhythm was generating. Another boy was sliding up the hallway. His gold nerves merged perfectly with the hallway. He merged perfectly with the mirror in the hallway. The boy looked at Johnny. Johnny wanted to run, but the movie kept moving as planned. The boy took Johnny, he pressed him against a locker. He drove it in, he drove it home, he drove it deep in Johnny. The boy disappeared. Johnny fell on his knees, started crashing his head against a locker, started laughing hysterically when suddenly Johnny gets a feeling. He's been surrounded by horses, 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 coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, 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 singing on how to pony, like Boney Maroney. Do you know how to twist?
Now, you wrote for several years before actually performing in a rock and roll kind of setting and performing with music. When you started putting the two together, did you have any idea that you could sing? Had you used your voice that way before?
No, not really. I mean, I used to daydream when I was a kid about being an opera singer. And I loved Maria Callas. And my mother's a really nice singer. She, you know, had sort of like a 30s style jazz voice. And my father had a nice voice. But I never thought about singing. I think I sang in the school choir or something, but I didn't really excel or have any real gift. But what I did have, I think, always was I've always, for some reason, been comfortable talking in front of people or performing in front of people. And I guess I got a lot of guts. But I never really had that great a voice. I think it's basically guts.
Well, speaking of guts, when you first started reading, you've said that you were reading, you know, early on, often in bars that weren't places if you'd be likely to hear a poet.
No, they weren't.
What kind of places did you read in before you started?
Wherever I could. You know, I wasn't really accepted in the poet clique. I didn't have a lot of respect for poets, and I thought most of the poets, the more academic way of breaking into the poetry circle, it wasn't interesting to me. I didn't really relate to them, and I thought most of the poetry readings I went to were boring, and it just wasn't my scene. So I started pursuing different venues to perform my poetry, and I just read anywhere that anybody would take me, usually for free, just to get the experience, or for $5 or $10. And sometimes I'd be the opening act, you know? So I'd play like in a bar that had like a little rock band and some little blues band, and I'd go on before the blues band, and you know, nobody was interested in what I had to say. You know, they weren't interested in hearing poetry, or, you know, they wanted to hear music and they were half drunk or whatever. But I figured they told me I had 15 minutes or 20 minutes on that little stage, that was my stage and I was going to fight for it. So I usually spent, if I had 20 minutes, 14 minutes arguing that I had the right to be there.
Arguing with the audience?
Yeah, and then finishing with Piss Factory. And which usually I did such a strong reading of it that it would take them off guard and they'd kind of like it. And then I was gone. But
what was the arguing with them like?
Like sparring, you know, like the I can't, you know, like get a job, go in the kitchen where you belong. And, you know, I was really good at sparring. I really loved Johnny Carson and I really studied his whole monologue thing and the way Johnny Carson would go back and forth with the audience. And that was actually more in my mind of what I wanted to do, sort of be like Johnny Carson.
Let me play the first track of your first LP, and this is Gloria. What made you decide to rework this song?
Well, truthfully, it was in the beginning, it was just Lenny and I, and then we brought in a piano player who was Richard Soul. He was quite young, quite gifted. He was actually a classical piano player. But he had a great sense of rhythm. So it was just the three of us, a guitar, piano, and I. And we did very simple songs because the configuration was so simple. And we just chose songs that were basically three chords so I could improvise over them. Because I didn't want to just, like, do songs, you know.
Right.
I didn't want to do, like, lame approximations of songs. So what we
Patti
did
Smith
is,
covers the hits.
we did what we called field work, you know. Uh-huh. So we'd pick songs that had basically three chords that I could like and just sort of use them as a springboard. I didn't really have any interest in covering Gloria, but it had three chords and I liked the rhythm, and we just sort of used it for our own design, the same as Land of a Thousand Dances. Land of a Thousand Dances became really like a battleground for all kinds of adolescent excursions. And so that's why we picked songs like that. I remember I wrote the ad copy for our first album. And the ad copy I wrote for Horses was three chords merged with the power of the word.
That's great, yeah.
That was our philosophy.
Track from Patti Smith's newly reissued album Horses. Our interview was recorded in June 1996. A few months before that, she published a book of poems dedicated to her late friend and former roommate, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. He became one of the most controversial artists of his generation, famous for his photographs of nudes in erotic and sadomasochistic poses. Mapplethorpe died of AIDS in 1989 at the age of 42. In April of 1996, I asked Patti Smith about the black and white photo that Mapplethorpe took for the cover of her first album, Horses, which is also on the cover of the new reissue. She's wearing black pants, a man's white shirt, with an undone skinny black tie hanging down from her neck. Her jacket is slung across her shoulder. What was it like to be photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe?
Well, I was his first model, so when we were younger, he followed me around continuously with a cheap Polaroid camera, and I got to a point where I'd start hiding because I didn't want to be photographed anymore. But I always actually enjoyed being photographed by Robert. It was always quick, simple, very little direction, very natural. Until the end of his life, we always did our work together very quickly in natural light. And being photographed by Robert, not just from myself, but other models have said the same thing. There exists between him and his model trust. And I always felt working with Robert, the trust of our friendship. We trusted each other as people. We cared about each other as people. And so when we worked together, we extended that same care into our work. I wanted his work to be good. He wanted to present me in the best light. So that's what I mostly think about, is that element of trust.
He took the photograph, perhaps the most famous photograph of you that was on your the cover of your album, Horses, I think in 1975, in which you're wearing a kind of oversized white shirt and an undone tie with a suit jacket slung over your shoulder. Tell us how that photograph came about.
Well, we wanted to take the cover, and Robert knew where he wanted to take it. It was up in Sam Wagstaff's apartment in New York City, which was a very white room. And there was a triangle of light that used to come through a window, and he was extremely interested in photographing that triangle. And we went up there, and I remember the light started changing, and he wanted us to hurry up, and we had to run. We couldn't get a cab, and we had to run as fast as we could because he could really feel the light changing. And in terms of my clothing, it was just my usual clothes. I used to like... I really wanted to have a Baudelairean type of look. I wanted a black and white sort of a mixture of just how I was and a little 19th century feel in it. But in the end, the final photograph, which some people have made quite a bit of, the particular pose or stance in the photograph, was really a tribute to Frank Sinatra.
The Capitol years.
Well, no, actually, he did a movie. I think it was called. I don't think it was Pal Joey. It was the Joey Lewis story, and Joey Lewis was a singer that got in trouble with the mob and got his throat cut, and he wound up a comedian. I don't know if you remember that, but...
Yeah, it's the movie that All the Way comes from. The Joker is Wild, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. The Joker is Wild. Appropriate title. The last scene of it, Frank Sinatra's walking alone down a dark street with a lantern. There's a lantern-lit street, and he sort of philosophically talking to himself in a pane of glass, and he slings his coat over his shoulder and... philosophically walks into the city sunset. But I always thought it was cool the way he slung his coat over his shoulder. So there was only a couple of photographs in that particular shooting like that, but that was the one Robert picked, the Frank Sinatra shot.
Now, I know when you were young, you were a Jehovah's Witness for several years. Was that the religion of your parents or something that you joined independently?
My mother's religion. Mm-hmm. I was a Jehovah's Witness till I was about 12. And in those days, Jehovah's Witnesses were stricter about one's pursuits outside of being a witness. And I decided I wanted to be an artist. I went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art with my father and saw art in person and immediately wanted to become a painter. And it some of the my desires sort of collided with their teachings. So I made the choice. I left the Witnesses to become an artist. I think they're a much more benevolent and more understanding group right now. And but at that time, they I didn't get any sympathy or encouragement for that kind of way of life. So I my drive to be an artist was extremely strong as a 12 or 13-year-old.
And did you try other organized religions, or was that the end of organized religion for you for some time?
No, I looked in, I thought of, for a while I wanted to be Jewish, but I think that was my Anne Frank period. I didn't realize that you just can't be, you know, you don't turn Jewish. Well, I had great sympathy. I mean, when I grew up, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was, you know, of course, a lot of information came out about the Holocaust, and there were trials and things, and I felt devastated about that as a young girl, and I got very interested in the Jewish faith. But I never really, I think once I left my first organized religion, I found, as I checked each one out, that really wasn't for me. I say my prayers and continue my studies. But I basically, for me, I don't really prescribe or need a religion. What's important to me is my communication with what I perceive to be God.
Now, what a lot of people might find confusing or paradoxical is, on one hand, this kind of spiritual inclination you've had since childhood and never stopped having, and at the same time, your art is the kind of art a lot of people would describe as blasphemous.
Well, I think blasphemy is just a form of exploring, you know, it's just a, you know, youthful, exuberant manner of exploring the whole concept. I think I've often found the people that are the most blasphemous are often the wind up to be the truest believers, because they've taken the time actually to question, pull things apart, be angry, and then either submit or, you know, find certain answers. A lot of people misconstrued, for instance, the statement, "Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine."
Right.
People constantly came up to me and said, "You're an atheist. You don't believe in Jesus." And I said, obviously, I believe in him. I've stated, you know, I've made a statement, you know, which, you know, I'm saying that, you know, the concept of Jesus I believe in. I just wanted the freedom. I wanted to be free of him. I was 20 years old and when I wrote that, and it was sort of my youthful manifesto. In other words, I didn't want to, I guess I didn't want to be good, you know, and I didn't want to, but I didn't want him to have to worry about me, or I didn't want him taking responsibility for my wrongdoings or my youthful explorations. I wanted to be free. So it's really a statement about freedom.
Patti Smith recorded in June 1996. Her first album, Horses, has just been reissued in a 30th anniversary edition that includes a 2005 concert version of songs from the CD. Here's a song from that concert.
The wall is high, the black bone, the baby in my arms, in her swaddling clothes, and I knew so. Flame and I feel like just some misplaced jump. Rolled in the grass and to spit out the gas and I lay.